I got to admit up front, I'm going to put a little more stuff in than I normally would, stuff that'd be more appropriate for law school, but you're still going to find it real interesting because it has to do with history and it's not going to distress you at all. So, but it's going to have a little more flavor toward that direction, which means we'll get a little less into the political side, a little less in some of the stuff going on in the states and in federal Congress right now. So we're going to look more on that. And in doing that, we're going to talk about how the First Amendment has changed from what it was intended when it was proposed in 1789 across the years, across the 200 and something years now, 207 years actually, to where we are in 1996. And let's start by looking at where we are. Now, we're very involved in the legal community. We've been involved in a number of cases, even at the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's just start with some recent federal court cases. This one called Warsaw versus Tehachapi. Now, this federal, and by the way, you do understand the First Amendment is, which is the amendment that contains two of the three religion clauses of the First Amendment. So by looking at the First Amendment, we're just kind of looking at the overview of religious activities in America. But this case, called Warsaw versus Tehachapi, comes from a federal district court, Eastern District of California. The federal court says it violates our form of government, violates the U.S. Constitution for a cemetery to have a cross in the cemetery. The court points out that if someone were to see a cross in public, it would cause that person emotional distress and would thus constitute an injury in fact, just to see a cross in public. Now, in my opinion, that's a ridiculous ruling, but it doesn't change the fact that's a federal court ruling. That has great impact, particularly in that district. Here's a case called Brittany K. Settle versus Dixon County School Board. This was settled U.S. Supreme Court just a few months ago. This case started when Brittany K. Settle received the same assignment that everyone else in her English class had received. And that is write a research paper. Now, the teacher didn't care what they wrote it on because they were trying to teach the students to use research documents. So the assignment was choose a topic and find four research documents that you can use in this paper. So several of the kids chose spiritual topics, although not Christian topics. I mean, one of them chose reincarnation. One of them chose the occult. One of them chose spiritualism. But Brittany K. Settle did choose the life and times of Jesus Christ as her topic. For choosing that topic, she received a zero, and that zero was upheld all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. All the other topics were fine, but it's unconstitutional for you to write about Jesus Christ in a report at public school. This case, Commonwealth versus Chambers, is a case we were involved with at the U.S. Supreme Court. Started in Pennsylvania, a man named Carl Chambers was on trial for his life. During that trial, the jury for several days watched testimony and forensics and evidence and witnesses. And when the jury finally was given the case to decide, they came back with a very quick decision that said Carl Chambers was guilty. He was convicted and sentenced for having taken an axe handle and brutally clubbed to death a 71-year-old woman in order to steal her Social Security check. Now, in all cases of that stature, it's appealed, and so the appeal proceeded on. When the appeal reached the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, there were some 27 points that they had in the appeal. And when it reached the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania upheld 26 of the 27 points. They upheld all the evidence, all the witness, all the presentation, etc. But they overturned the jury's sentence because one occurrence had happened. Matter of fact, the court said, despite the brutal nature of this crime, despite this tragic murder, and despite all the evidence that's been presented, we're forced to overturn the sentence because they said that in a statement of less than 5 seconds, the prosecuting attorney had mentioned 7 words from the Bible out loud in the courtroom. And the court said, as bad as that murder was, we definitely can't have you mention a Bible verse out loud. Now we've got to reverse the sentence, given a brutal murder because you mentioned a Bible verse. I just love free speech. It's so much fun. Now, well, at least if it's not religious, it's a lot of fun. This case, Inga Bresson versus Jackson Public Schools, originated in Mississippi. The decision came down on this January the 10th past. This started when Senator Roger Wicker in Mississippi, who is now a freshman U.S. congressman, he said, you know, it's ridiculous that our kids are confused about whether or not it's okay for them to pray. We want our students in Mississippi to know that student-initiated prayers are fine. If a kid wants to pray, there's nothing to keep him from praying if he wants to pray. It's fine for him to do that. So they passed a state law to clarify superintendents, teachers, and the kids themselves that it's okay to pray if you want to pray. If you initiate it, if it's your prayer, that's fine. That's just free speech. It just happens to be religious. Well, obviously, it did reach the court, and the court disagreed with that conclusion. Matter of fact, the court said student-initiated prayer is unconstitutional. You can't have kids praying if they want to pray. They said, we will only allow prayer in one sitting. They said, that is high school graduation. The court said the reason we'll allow prayer in that sitting is, they said, because that is a once-in-a-lifetime event. And the court said, now, since prayer is also a once-in-a-lifetime event, it's appropriate to pray at high school graduation. Okay? Then we've got this case, federal court. Now, this came down on May the 5th last year. It's called Jane Doe versus Santa Fe Independent School District. It also dealt with graduation prayers. But this particular court said, there's no problem praying at graduation, so long as you pray the right way. I'll just read you out of the court case here. It says, this court will allow prayer if it's a typical non-denominational prayer. The prayer can refer to God or the Almighty, but the prayer must not refer to Jesus. And make no mistake, this court is going to have United States Marshal in attendance at graduation. If any student offends this court, that student will be summarily arrested and will face 6 months incarceration. Anyone who violates these orders is going to wish that he or she had died as a child when this court gets through with it. Let's see if I've got this right. Under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, under the court's interpretation of it, if you want to thumb your nose at country and at patriotism, go burn a flag. We'll protect you for that under the First Amendment. Matter of fact, if you want to thumb your nose at community values or traditional morality, get involved in new dancing. We'll protect you for that, too. As a matter of fact, if you want to mention Jesus Christ in a respectful manner, we'll give you 6 months in jail for that one, all under the same amendment. What a strange interpretation this is. Now, I could go through literally hundreds of these cases, and you know of lots of others yourself. You've heard of these. I mean, we have stacks of hundreds of these. But the question is, why did they do this? Why do we get these kind of decisions? In every single one of these cases, and in the others, there is always the claim by the court that this is what the First Amendment was given us for. This is the reason the founders gave it. This is their intent. And those are key words. These cases will talk about the intent of the First Amendment, the purpose of the First Amendment, the mandate of the First Amendment. And they will cite occasionally one or two references from history to give clout to it. And so what happens is you get into this argument of original intent. Now, some people don't like that argument. They say the Constitution shouldn't have original intent. It ought to be able to evolve and change and keep up with the people's values. And we'll get into that argument in a little bit. But for the time being, it is the courts that have brought up original intent because they use words like purpose and mandate and intent and et cetera. So we're going to start right there. Now, if we're going to start talking about something like original intent, and by the way, before I go any further, I got to tell you, I read a case recently where the judge was saying, you know, 200 years ago was a long time. We really can't be sure what our founding fathers wanted 200 years ago. I mean, this argument that age and time clouds intent, now, if you've never heard that, you will. And when you hear it, you reject it because that's utter nonsense. You just go to the law library. I'm sure the law library will have it. If not, I know the university library will have it. Look for the writings of George Washington. When you get there, start counting the volumes. 1, 2, 3. 97 volumes of the personal writings of George Washington. And that's a man with an opinion on every subject under the sun. And that is characteristic of the founding fathers. There's 250 founding fathers, and they did on paper what we do with cameras and tapes and VCRs. He says that's why James Madison has 18 volumes of personal writings. John Quincy Adams has 23. John Adams has 33. Ben Franklin has 40. Thomas Jefferson has 60. Alexander Hamilton has 60 volumes, and I could keep going. But the idea, you get it. It's written there. It's easy to know their intent if we want to get back into it. Now, in our organization, we've been very blessed. In our special library that we have, we own some 70,000 documents that predate 1812. We have thousands of the original works of the founding fathers. I mean, this stuff is out there. And I brought some of the very rare works that I'll show you tonight as we go through this. But it's easy to know their intent. But this whole separation of church and state thing that we hear so much about, that the courts rely on so heavily, that this is the original intent of the founders, let's start with that. Let's start at the very beginning, because the person the courts love to use most of all is obviously Thomas Jefferson. And this is a guy that has popularized the phrase separation of church and state as we know it today. And the court will talk about Jefferson's metaphor, and there's several descriptions that are given that. But nonetheless, it starts with Thomas Jefferson. So how did this phrase come about, the separation of church and state phrase? Well, it happened after the letter which contains the phrase the courts now rely on so much today is a letter that happened after Thomas Jefferson became president. When he was president in 1801, he was America's first anti-federalist president. He and Sam Adams and Elbridge Gerry and George Mason and others had founded the anti-federalist party, and the platform was very simple. Keep the federal government out of our lives and keep it off our backs. So he's the first anti-federal president that was there. Now, when he was inaugurated, there was one denomination in America that was more elated than any other denomination. If you look at the records of the ratifying conventions for the various states, you'll find that ministers, huge numbers of ministers were in those ratifying conventions for the Constitution. And you'll find that of all denominations represented, the group that voted against the federal Constitution most often were the Baptists, because they were afraid it would consolidate power into one federal government and they'd be the victims of that consolidated power. So the Baptists were particularly happy to have Jefferson as president, an anti-federalist. And so Jefferson got flooded with letters from all sorts of Baptist organizations, just all sorts of high praise, what wonderful it is, wonderful thing it is to have you as president. One of those letters is dated November 7, 1801. That letter came from the Danbury Baptist Association of Danbury, Connecticut. Now, Reverend Jeremiah Dodge and several other ministers there signed off on the letter. And there's a short little letter with three main points to it. They said, point number one, President Jefferson, we believe that God has raised you up for such a time as this. Point number two, our prayers are with you and we look for excellent things from your administration. Point number three, they said, we are, however, very concerned that the First Amendment guarantees us our free exercise of religion. They said, we think that's totally wrong. We think that our free exercise of religion is an inalienable right given us by God, and we're concerned that the fact that free exercise of religion appears in the First Amendment might someday mean that the federal government will feel empowered to regulate our religious liberties, to tell us what we can and can't do with religious exercises. And so that was their concern. That was the letter they sent off. Now, that letter was, as I pointed out, just a very short little letter, short and succinct, and they wrote it out very clearly, and that letter is on record in the Library of Congress in the Jefferson Papers. Now, Jefferson replied to that letter, and his reply is dated January the 1st, 1802. And his letter, his reply is also very short, and it's in his own hand. And in that little reply, three little points. He said, thank you for your letter of congratulations. I, too, believe God has raised me up for this. He said, point number two, thank you for your prayers. I, too, am looking for good things from this administration. He said, point number three, he said, your right to worship God is an inalienable right. He called it a natural right, which was defined, by the way, in this little book right here. This is a law book from 1794. This is a later edition. I have the 1769 version, which the founders used. But this little book called Blackstone's Commentaries on the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson said was the Bible for American lawyers. He said American lawyers used this book like Muslims used the Koran. That if it wasn't here, it just didn't happen in American law. So he went to here and he said the definition of an inalienable right, he gave that natural right, which went back to Richard Hooker and Gratian and some other philosophers. He said, look, your right to worship God is your God-given inalienable right, and we in the federal government will never mess with it. He says, as a matter of fact, the First Amendment has erected a wall of separation between church and state, which will ensure that the government will never stop your religious activities. So Jefferson's full letter on separation, when you read the entire thing, is quite clear in its intent. This is what we have the First Amendment for, to keep the federal government from stopping any public religious activity. Guess who stops them all now? Federal government. And guess on what basis? On Jefferson's letter. Well, not Jefferson's letter. Because, you see, this is where Jefferson's letter becomes interesting. Jefferson's letter was rarely used. The next time it appeared in any Supreme Court setting was in 1878 in the case Reynolds versus United States. In that case, the issue was raised. Thomas Jefferson's letter was reprinted in its entirety in that 1878 case. They gave the whole thing and said, look, the purpose, according to Jefferson's metaphor, is the government won't be stopping religious activities. That's what he gave it for. And so that's the way they used the letter. Now, the next time Jefferson's letter appears, now here it is. Jefferson writes it in 1802. The first time it appears in Supreme Court is 1878, and the next time it appears is in 1947 in the case Everson versus Board of Education. And in that court setting, the court did not provide the entire letter. It provided only eight words from the letter, a wall of separation between church and state. That 1947 Supreme Court said the First Amendment has erected a wall of separation between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not allow the slightest breach. Took Jefferson's letter as the basis of not allowing religion and anything else to touch. You've got to keep these things apart. And Jefferson's letter totally out of context. But this is the source of the letter. And again, this is all public record. You can get out of Jefferson's own writing and so many others. But this is where the phrase comes from. Now, if we were to ignore the way it's used today and say, you know, what was Jefferson's intent? Well, we could easily say, well, he made it clear because that was not the only letter he wrote on this issue. You see, we can go into Jefferson's writing in a number of years, across the decades, and we can see, for example, I'll show you four of his letters. This one here, Jefferson, this is to Samuel Miller in 1808. Jefferson said, I consider the government of the United States, the federal government, as interdicted or prohibited by the Constitution from intermeddling with the religious institutions or exercises. That's what the First Amendment's there for, to keep the federal government from messing with religious exercises. He said, can't mess with it. They can't stop it. They can't get involved in prohibiting it. He said, no power over the freedom of religion is delegated to the United States by the Constitution. There it is again. He said, hey, the Constitution has not given the United States any power over any religious exercise. Now, let me point out to you, let's get this up front, because we've lost this in what's called the selective incorporation. I'll go into that later. But the first 10 amendments were the anti-federalist part of the Constitution. See, the Constitution was the federalist part, and of the 55 founders that were at the Constitutional Convention, we only had 39 to sign the Constitution, because so many of the other guys said, we're scared to death that the federal government will take over all of our rights and all of our powers. And so people like George Mason and Luther Martin and Oliver Ellsworth and Elbridge Gerry and John Randolph, they all ran home to their states and said, don't ratify the Constitution until they give us some kind of guarantee that the federal government's not going to take us all over. And so that was the Bill of Rights. They came up with those 10 amendments to say what the federal government, and only the federal government, could not do.
And see, first off, the First Amendment was designed only to tell the federal Congress what it could not do. Congress can make no law establishing a religion. That's the federal Congress. And so that's the way it was for all those years. Now, Jefferson reemphasizes that again and again. That's his Kentucky Resolutions of 1795 and 96. In his letter to the Methodist Episcopal Church, he said, "Our excellent Constitution has not placed our religious rights under the power of any public functionary." I wonder if the Supreme Court knows that. You know, obviously they don't. Guess where all of our religious rights are today? They tell us if we can pray, when we can pray, how we can pray, and even what we say in our prayers. Tell me that our rights aren't under the power of a public functionary. And that's what Jefferson said the First Amendment was there for, to keep that from happening. In the same way, this is his second inaugural address. He said, "In matters of religion, I consider that its free exercise is placed by the Constitution independent of the powers of the general federal government." Again, this is what we have the First Amendment for, to make sure the federal government can't invade our religious liberties in any way, shape, fashion, or form. So Jefferson's tone is real clear. But you know, you can't just deal with Jefferson on this issue, because there are 250 founding fathers. And one guy cannot by himself pass a legislative initiative. It takes a majority of these guys. So it's fair to look at what the other founders did in this issue as well. And there's some real clear intent of what the founders did here. Now, for example, if we start with this group right here. Now, this group is a 1789 Congress of the United States. It's James Madison standing right square there in the middle. And the significance of this group is this is the group which framed the First Amendment. Now, the Constitution of the United States requires that everything said on the floor of the House and Senate be recorded for public consumption. That's a constitutional requirement, which is why you can go to a public library, a law library, a university library, you can get the records of Congress out, and you can read it for yourself to see exactly what they wanted. Now, if you were to go to this group right here, they framed the First Amendment from June the 7th through September the 25th of 1789. You can read for yourself the entire debate. These 90 founding fathers going after it. Here's what the First Amendment will do. Here's what it won't do. We're not going to permit this, but we will allow this. They go back and forth for months. And you know what's striking about those months of discussions? Months of recorded discussions. Not one of the 90 founding fathers who gave us the First Amendment, not even one of them ever even mentioned the phrase separation of church and state in months of discussions. It does seem like if that had been their purpose for the First Amendment, somebody would have said something about it. 90 that gave us that never one time mentioned the phrase. And yet today you think that that is the phrase used by every founding father forever. 250 founding fathers, we've gone through the majority of their writings. We have found less than a dozen that have ever used the phrase, and none of them used it more than twice in their lifetime. You know, we're talking 60, 70, 80 years of writing here. This was not a big deal to them. What was a big deal was the federal government stayed out of their lives in the era of religion. And that's what you will find them writing about. And that's why, by the way, when they finally reached their consensus here, they said, "We are trying to prevent what we had in Great Britain. We don't want the federal government making us all one denomination. We're not going to all be Catholics or Anglicans or any other denomination." And that's why it said that Congress can make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting free exercise thereof. Now, that's the First Amendment as given us by the Founding Fathers. Now, their intent was very clear that Congress can't make a law. But the interesting thing that gets us in trouble today is this word right here, religion. You see this word religion, people say, you know, I wonder what the Founding Fathers meant by religion. So they go grab a 1996 dictionary and look up religion, which is a bad move. If you don't know what they meant, you look at their dictionaries. Better yet, you just go back to the records of Congress, because right here, James Madison, in the records of Congress, August the 15th, 1789, he defined the word religion as used in their dictionaries at that time. James Madison said the word religion meant a single national denomination. Given their language, their dictionaries, they could not have said it any more clearly. Congress cannot make a law respecting the establishment of a single national denomination. Now, that's their concept of separation of church and state. But to say that that means you can't have a cross in the cemetery or you can't have a prayer or whatever else, that's a long way from what they intended, which we'll get into a little more later. Now, there's other things that show the founders' intent. If we, for example, were to look at this little map here, which is the territories of the United States at the time of the Revolution, at the time of the Constitution, we had 13 states, but the Founding Fathers were concerned with the fact that we had a lot of people living in territories that hadn't yet become states, the Mississippi Territory, the Ohio Territory. They said, how are these people going to become states in the United States? We've got all this territory. How do you become states? So they framed what's called the Northwest Ordinance. Now, if you go to the law books, you will find that in the U.S. Code and in the U.S. Code annotated under what's called the Organic Law of the United States, there are four things. That means there are four foundational documents on which all of our laws rest. One is the Articles of Confederation, two is the Declaration, three is the Constitution, and four is the Northwest Ordinance. Now, the Northwest Ordinance is significant because the founders gave very tedious, detailed requirements on what it takes to become a state in the United States. This is how territories achieved statehood. Now, that was passed by the Congress. Interestingly, this Congress passed it on the House passed it on the 17th of July, 1789. 2 weeks later, the Senate passed it on August the 4th, and then George Washington signed it into law on August the 7th of 1789. Now, if you remember the dates I gave you, the First Amendment was framed from June the 7th through September the 25th. Well, this is done right in the middle of that by the same guys who gave us the First Amendment. So in the midst of framing the First Amendment, they give us the Northwest Ordinance. So what? So Article 3, the Founding Fathers said that no territory could become a state in the United States unless the schools in that territory were teaching religion and morality as well as knowledge. Federal law signed by George Washington, passed by the guys who gave us the First Amendment, said, we're not even going to let you in the United States unless you make sure that your schools are teaching religion and morality as well as knowledge. And that's why if you go through the territorial papers or the state constitutions of states like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, go through the states and look at their state constitutions and their territorial papers, and they say forever in the schools of this state, religion and morality will be taught as well as knowledge. Now, why in the world is that in all those state constitutions? Because that's the federal law signed by George Washington, says we're not going to let you in unless you do it. Matter of fact, interesting thing happened in January in North Carolina. There was a student attending public school in North Carolina that during the passing period, at his locker, he would give out religious literature to other kids in school there. He's doing it in his locker, and it was non-disruptive. Everybody agreed it was not in curricular periods, it was in non-curricular periods, but he gives out this gospel literature. Well, teacher found out about it, told the principal told the superintendent, and they landed on this kid with all 6 feet. They said, you will take this religious stuff out of here. You will not bring it back to the school. This violates the Constitution. This is illegal. You cannot do this again. That kid had the guts and the gumption to reach into his locker and pull out a copy of the North Carolina Constitution. And he just opened it. He said, you know, he said, it says here that forever in the schools of this state, religion and morality will be taught as well as knowledge. I said, you're kidding. In our Constitution? Yeah, there it is right there. See, it still is there in a number of constitutions. People just aren't aware of it today. Tell me the Founding Fathers didn't have a clear intent. You see, their legislative intent is also there as well. Now, there's a lot of other indications that we can go to as well. Not just those things. The Northwest Ordinance is a lot of fun. But let's get into the practices of the three branches. Okay, let's start again. We're going to go back to this Congress because they're an important Congress. They're the guys that gave us the first. Do you know what they did on the day that they approved the First Amendment? They also passed a unanimous resolution asking for George Washington to issue a National Day of Prayer and Thanksgiving. On the same day they did that. And so Washington did. Washington agreed with that. He issued this National Day of Prayer and Thanksgiving, and you ought to read it. It is in the messages and papers of the presidents. It's going to be in any library. And it is not some bland little deistic document. I mean, it's heavy-duty religious all the way through. He's encouraging the people to pray, to seek God, to attend church, all sorts of religious encouragement. Of course, today, under the new interpretation, government's not permitted to endorse or to encourage religion. I guess nobody told George Washington that. I mean, what does he know? And so Washington here is encouraging religion at the insistence of the Congress who gave us the First Amendment, and it was a huge National Day of Prayer. Now, not only the first executive branch, but let's go to the first judicial branch. They're a lot of fun. Now, these are four of the 6 members on the original U.S. Supreme Court. You have down here James Iredell. This is John Jay. This man right here is John Blair, signer of the Constitution. Here's James Wilson, signer of the Constitution. These guys in the original U.S. Supreme Court, and the court records are all there. The U.S. Supreme Court has all this, and they've reprinted all volumes of documentary history of the Supreme Court. These guys had circuits. Now, judges today still have their circuits. Supreme Court justices, all these states under them, so appeals go to specific justices. Well, that was started back there. They had circuits. The difference was, instead of bringing all the cases to the federal capital to try, they went out into the different regions and held court in Boston and in Portsmouth and over in Hartford. And they held court all over the country. And so they would save up the cases, and when they'd come to town, they'd argue those cases, convene the grand jury, see if there was evidence there. If there was, let's deal with the case. And so as these judges, now, again, we're not talking about lightweights on the original Supreme Court, because you've got John Jay, who's the original Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He's considered one of the three men most responsible for us having the Constitution. He's one of the three co-authors of the Federalist Papers, which told us what the Constitution's all about. Then you've got people like James Wilson, a signer of the Constitution, also an original justice on the court. You've got people like this man, Samuel Chase. Now, Samuel Chase was a signer of the Declaration, but he became an original justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. You've got people here like Bushrod Washington, who was the nephew of George Washington, who was the legal clerk for the state of Virginia. He became a Supreme Court justice. You got people like James Iredell, You have William Patterson, who is a signer of the Constitution from New Jersey. I mean, these aren't lightweight guys on the Supreme Court. According to Supreme Court records, these justices on the U.S. Supreme Court would never allow a jury to go out and deliberate on anything until they first had prayer over the jury. First thing they did was have prayer for the jury, that jury would find a true verdict, that would find an honest verdict, that God would show them the truth they needed to arrive at that verdict. Prayer in the court, can you imagine what that would do today? If we had prayer in the court today. What did they know? They just wrote the Constitution. Again, the practices of these guys make clear what their intent was. They didn't want a federal denomination, but to say you couldn't have public practices, nonsense. They did that. And then we don't just stop at the executive and the judicial. Let's go on to the legislative branch. Now, the legislative branch first started in New York City, and then the Congress was in Philadelphia. But finally, they got Washington, D.C. They got the Capitol built. And so right around 1800, 1801, we moved into Washington, D.C. as the permanent home of federal government. It was the fourth year of John Adams' term. He was the first one to occupy the White House. One of the first things the U.S. Congress did when they moved into the Capitol at Washington, D.C., Congress voted that the U.S. Capitol was also to be used as a church building, that the Capitol was to become a church building. And so if you look at the writings of people like John Quincy Adams, who was a U.S. senator at that time from Massachusetts, in his diary, he talks about going to church at the Capitol. He said, attended public service at the Capitol where Mr. Rattoon, an Episcopal clergyman from Baltimore, had the sermon. And then he also talks about religious services usually performed on Sundays either at the Treasury office or at the Capitol. Now, somehow this doesn't quite balance out with what we thought the First Amendment was all about. He says, I went both forenoon and afternoon to the Treasury, attended services twice that day, both services at the Treasury. You mean the government building is a church building? Yeah, absolutely was. He said, well, our founders weren't supposed to believe this. They weren't supposed to want this. They wanted the separation church and state, which is what we hear so much about. Now, it doesn't stop there. I mean, the problem is really that we have fallen into what Woodrow Wilson described. And Wilson was himself a great historian. If you've ever seen his work on the history of the United States, Wilson said, a nation which does not remember what it was yesterday does not know what it is today nor what it's trying to do. He said, we're trying to do a futile thing if we don't know where we've come from or what we've been about. Now, you will find that history is one of the greatest political tools that exists today. Why do we have the decisions that we have out of these court cases? Because we are told that this aligns with our history. And so if you can misportray history, and I was talking to an international historian recently, he said, you know, he said, a strange thing. He said, America is the only country I know of where you have groups that intentionally distort your history. I mean, they portray it other than what happened. But see, that has great political consequence. It has great policy effect. And so if you don't know what your history is, if you don't know what was designed, if you think that the Founding Fathers intended the separation that we have now, crosses and cemeteries and mentioning Jesus and prayers, it's because the history view is warped. And this is all, again, dealing with original intent. We'll get out of that in a minute, but let's deal with this for just a minute. You know, I think one of the greatest proofs that exists today that we have forgotten our history is that when courts like to talk about separation, they immediately go to Thomas Jefferson. They get into constitutional issues on separation of church and state, and so who do they quote as the constitutional authority? It's Thomas Jefferson. Matter of fact, as I pointed out, in the first 150 years of the U.S. Supreme Court, Jefferson was cited in one case in 150 years. Do you know in the last 50 years, Thomas Jefferson has been cited as the constitutional authority in over 3,000 cases? We never use him. Now he's the only one we use? Now how did this happen? Because we've forgotten our history. You see, when he became president, one of his friends, Dr. Joseph Priestley, Priestley is not only a minister and an educator and author, he's a scientist. He's a guy who isolated oxygen as a gas and six other gases. I mean, he was a genuine scientist. But he wrote a biography about Thomas Jefferson, and he sent it to Jefferson at the White House. He said, Thomas, he said, before I print this, I want you to read it and see if you see anything wrong with this biography about yourself. If you do, you let me know and I'll change it. Jefferson read the biography and he said, you know, he said, you got a serious mistake here. There's one thing that has to be fixed. And this is what Jefferson replied in his letter. He said, one passage in the paper you enclosed me must be corrected. And it's the following. And this is the clause to which he objected. And all state it is yourself more than any other that planned and established it, that is the Constitution. Now this thing way back then said, Jefferson, you're a great constitutional scholar, you're a great constitutional authority. And Jefferson said, you know, you can't print that until you take that out of the book. He said, that is not true. He said, I was in Europe at the time the Constitution was planned, and I never saw it till after it was established. Now, you see, very few people today realize that Jefferson wasn't even in America when we did the First Amendment or the Constitution. He wasn't here. You've got 55 eyewitnesses at the Constitutional Convention that know the intent of the Constitution. You've got another 90 eyewitnesses in the first Congress who gave us the First Amendment. That's 145 eyewitnesses to the intent of the Constitution and the First Amendment, and Jefferson is not in that group of 145. You know what that's like? I mean, we rely on him for everything today. That's like going into a court for a murder trial, and the judge says, now, during this murder trial, I'll allow no eyewitness testimony. But if you read about this in the newspaper, I'll let you testify. I mean, would never do it, but that's exactly what we've done with religious liberties. The guy who disqualified himself, the guy who was not in the country at the time, the guy who does not put any characteristic of best evidence is the only evidence that we use in these cases. And that just doesn't fly. You see, the problem we have is that 50 years ago, we were talking about people like this guy. Now, this man's name is Gouverneur Morris. Gouverneur Morris is a very important founding father. Very few recognize the name or the face today, but he's the final man to sign the Constitution of the United States, right there. Gouverneur Morris, that's his signature at the bottom, the last man to sign the Constitution. And here he stands right here. That's Gouverneur Morris. He is the most active member at the Constitutional Convention. This guy spoke on the floor of the convention 173 times. That was more than any other founder. And he's the most active member at the convention. He signs a document, and today nobody's ever heard his name or his face. I guarantee it, you'll recognize his handiwork. This is the man who physically wrote the Constitution of the United States. He is the penman of the Constitution. Now, doesn't it make sense that the guy who wrote the Constitution might understand the intent for the Constitution? I mean, maybe that's a stretch, but it seems to make sense. Why don't we ever talk about Gouverneur Morris? Because like so many of the other founding fathers and the heir of religious liberties, he's absolutely politically incorrect. You see, in 1789, when the Constitution was ratified, now he's another of these massive writers. We have scores of his volumes. Matter of fact, I'll show you one right here that I brought. This is right at 200 years old. This is one of Gouverneur Morris's original writings. This is one of his works here, an original, about 200 years old. But nonetheless, Gouverneur Morris, in 1790 and 1791, authored two works on the Constitution of the United States. Look what he told us in those works. He said, "Religion is the only solid basis for good morals. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man toward God." Now, that's not at all the tone we hear today. And what did he know? He just wrote the Constitution. See, this is the irony of not knowing our history. In the same way, this man, James Wilson, is a lot of fun. Now, you can always spot him because of the glasses he wears. Anytime you find those glasses, you found James Wilson. In any founding picture, James Wilson is the next to the last man to sign the Constitution. That's his name right there above Gouverneur Morris. There's James Wilson. And James Wilson is the guy over here, right? He's still wearing his glasses. There's James Wilson right there. Now, he is the second most active member of the Constitutional Convention. He spoke on the floor of the convention 168 times, second only to Gouverneur Morris. And so he's second most active. He signs a document. When George Washington becomes president, he puts James Wilson on the U.S. Supreme Court as an original justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, Wilson has scores of writings as well. But this is a significant one. This one right here is the first ever legal commentary on the Constitution of the United States. It's written by James Wilson. He authored America's first commentaries on the Constitution. He is responsible for laying the foundation for American jurisprudence. That is his claim to fame. I mean, he's a law professor at the law school in Philadelphia. University of Pennsylvania became. Nonetheless, he's a law professor there, and that's his work on the Constitution of the United States. And he wrote that so that every subsequent generation and judge and attorney would know just what they wanted. You know what he told us in his legal writings? He said, "Human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine." Now, already he says, you know, if you separate civil law from divine law, it's no good. You can't separate those two. He said, far from being rivals and enemies, he said, religion and law are friends. They're twin sisters. They're mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other. In his view, religion and law were inseparable, just like two yoke of oxen pointing in the same direction. It's ironic that his phraseology now is where we are today. I mean, they do run into each other. It's like a head-on collision today. You mention a Bible verse in the courtroom, the guy gets his murder sentence overturned. But back then, they said, hey, if you separate divine law from civil law, it's no good. You can't do that. He said, these are twins, and they're friends, and they're mutual assistants. Now, another man that's a lot of fun is this man. He's William Samuel Johnson. He, too, is a signer of the Constitution. He's from Connecticut. This is his signature right here, William Samuel Johnson. He's the man who has been over the table right here, William Samuel Johnson. Now, he's one of America's top educators. He's the first ever president of Columbia College in New York, which still exists today. And as a leading educator, he spoke at a number of public school graduations. We have the records of those public school graduations. Now, I've already intimated that that's a real trouble today with having what you can and can't do at public school graduations. And a lot of that dates back to a 1992 Supreme Court case called Lee versus Wiseman, a case in which we were involved. And that case started in Providence, Rhode Island, which is a good place to start this kind of case. Do you know that Providence, Rhode Island has had public schools for over 300 years? They wanted to do there that year what they'd done every other year, and that was have invocations, benedictions. That year they went to Rabbi Gutterman and they said, Rabbi, would you deliver the invocation, benediction for us this year? Rabbi said, be happy to. After Rabbi agreed to do that, school officials went to him and said, now, Rabbi, we've got to remind you of a few simple things here. Number one, this is a secular setting. Number two, this is a secular group. Number three, we need you to pray a secular prayer. That's an amazing... How do you pray a secular prayer? What is a secular prayer? I mean, and that was his thing. A secular prayer? Bless his heart, he knew what they wanted. They wanted a politically correct, non-offensive prayer that would offend no faith at all. And so he tried his best to accommodate that. He came back with an admittedly bland prayer. You know how bland it was? When this case was challenged and taken to district court, and district court actually argued over whether or not he'd prayed. Wasn't even sure it was a prayer when they got it. I think it's a prayer. You may have seen it. It ran in the newspapers nationally when this case made the Supreme Court. Well, his difficulty was, and it was a great little thing that he'd done here because, I mean, it was graduation time, and so he addressed the students on patriotism, and civic duties and responsibility and justice and all these great things, but he made the mistake of invoking the G word. I mean, he used the God word, three letters right up top, right at the very beginning. Because of that, it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. At the Supreme Court, that year, November the 6th, 10 o'clock in the morning, the hearing was held. An hour later, it's all over and done with. The next June, when the decision came down, by 5-4 margin, we lost. By 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said that if a student were to hear the public acknowledgement of God, if a student were to hear God mentioned aloud in public, the Supreme Court said that would constitute not only religious, but also psychological coercion against that student, simply to hear God mentioned aloud in public. So since that point in time, we've had real difficulty with what we can and can't do at graduation ceremonies. Now, when a decision like that comes down, there's always this riding implication in the back of people's minds that, you know, it's unconstitutional to have graduation prayers. Founding fathers would never want graduation prayers. Oh, yeah? Let's see what happened at public school graduation, William Samuel Johnson. He said, you this day have received a public education. He said, the purpose whereof has been to qualify you better to serve your Creator and your country. He said, now, you know that first off, we paid for your education with tax dollars to teach you how to live by the precepts of God's word, teach you how to serve God and country. He continued, he said, your first great duties, you are sensible, are those you owe to heaven, to your Creator, and to your Redeemer. He said, let these be ever present to your minds and exemplified in your lives and conduct. And he went through specific scripture after specific scripture for the rest of that oration, challenging these kids to good behavior, to good conduct, etc. And I guess it's kind of unfortunate that somebody didn't tell him that what he was doing was unconstitutional. I guess he just didn't realize that. You see, this is our irony. If we did the exact same religious practices of those who gave us the document today, they'd be struck down in that very same document. You know, another notable absence from any court records is the use of George Washington. And I don't think there's any way to question that this guy is a constitutional scholar. I mean, he's the president of the convention that gave us the Constitution. He's also the president of the United States that called for the Bill of Rights and oversaw its formation and ratification from start to finish. Washington's a constitutional expert. Now, as I pointed out, there's 97 volumes of Washington's writings. So how many hundreds of quotes do you want is what it boils down to. I'm not going to give you that many. What I'm going to do is go to this one right here. We've covered this thing. It's very delicate, but this is 1796. This is George Washington's farewell address. This farewell address right here in its entirety was considered a classic in America for well over 120 years. Matter of fact, for 100 years, this was bound as a single textbook for all of our schools. We have a number of states that by state law required their students once a year for the first 8 years of school to take a written exam on the state constitution, on the Declaration of Independence, on the U.S. Constitution, and on George Washington's farewell address. And those are the four documents that we studied for over 100 years, even with state law. What he does in here is finishes his 2 terms as America's first president. He sums up the whole thing. He said, guys, he said, here's what's brought us to this point. If we're going to survive, here's what we got to do. And he goes through a dozen pertinent warnings that could have been written yesterday. I mean, 200 years ago, he said, do not ever let the federal government get into deficit spending. It's one of his warnings 200 years ago. Man, we could sure use that today. We don't read his address anymore. He goes on through things on treaties, things on political parties and partisanship. It is great stuff, and that's why we studied it for so long. But the problem with it is that of the 12 warnings he gave in his farewell address, 4 were overtly religious. 4 of those 12 were just absolutely religious in nature. Now, I will point out, I've been appointed in the state of Texas on the textbook committee there for history and social studies, writing the textbooks for our public school kids there. Point out that in the last 50 years, we've not been able to find George Washington's farewell address in any textbook. just falling off the face of the earth. Now, we have found it in the last 5 years coming back into college textbooks, minus the four religious warnings. It's got the other eight, but not those four. So we cut that stuff out. So that appears to be the offensive part. Let me show you some of the things Washington said in his farewell address. And again, he's clearly a constitutional expert. He said, of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, he said, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Everything that makes politics work right, religion and morality, that's the foundation of it. He said, in vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism, or don't let this guy call himself a patriot, if he labors to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. If somebody says, hey, religion and morality, that doesn't mix with politics, he said, hey, don't let them call themselves an American patriot. Now, that's his standard. That's not mine. I'm just reading from there. He says, the mere politician equal to pious men ought to respect and cherish them. Also, at that point in his career, the French Revolution was in the midst of what it was doing, one of the greatest travesties of blood, human blood, in mankind's history. And so he addressed that for a bit. He said, you know, we have a real different philosophies here. He said, in France, they had this mentality that morality was a product of the mind, that if you just teach the right principles to the mind, you could be totally moral. He said, look at the result of that. He said, they separated religion from education. They separated religion from government. Tell me what kind of morality they have. He said, now, look at our American Revolution. Look at how it ended. There's quite a difference. And we are considered historically one of the most atrocity-free revolutions in the history of mankind. He said, why? He said, because of the French mentality. He said, do not ever let it come to America. This was his warning. He picked up, he said, and let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. He said, be really careful with that doctrine. If somebody says you can be moral without religion, he said, careful with that. He said, whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds, whatever you think schools are capable of doing, he said, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality will prevail in exclusion of religious principle. He said, it's just not going to work. He said, let me ask you a rhetorical question. He said, can you imagine what America would be like if we separated out this religious principle from everything we do? He said, let it simply be asked, where's the security for property and for reputation and for life that the sense of religious obligation deserves? He said, if we lose that conviction, you tell me what security we have for our property or our life or anything. He said, it all comes from those principles. He said, do not ever let those principles be separated. Ah, what did he know? He's just the father of the country, the president of the Constitutional Convention. You see, this is the lack of history that we now see. So when courts invoke original intent, they do that to get some credibility, to make it look like this is a historical tradition, but it's just not there. I'll show you one final founding father before we go into a little bit of transition, one final specific one. That founding father is Fisher Ames. Now, Fisher Ames is unfortunately another obscure founding father. He's very significant. He's one of the greatest orators America ever had. He's a founding father from Massachusetts. He's the guy that gave us 2-year terms for congressman. And according to the U.S. congressional record, August the 20th, 1789, Fisher Ames is the man who worded the First Amendment, the one that we now are talking about. Fisher Ames is the author of the First Amendment. He gave the House of Representatives language on that day. It went to the Senate on the 24th. The Senate revised it slightly. It went back, and then the conference committee basically adopted what Fisher Ames had come up with. So he is, for all intents and purposes, the author of the First Amendment. No one else had language as close as he did. A couple words were changed. Now, what is significant about Fisher Ames is, like the others, he was a prolific writer. Now, this is about 200 years old. This is one of his original volumes. He has an article in here that first ran in a national magazine, the Palladium Magazine. That article was called School Books. As a matter of fact, I can show it to you right here. The School Book article, it was fairly short, but boy, it was succinct and to the point, and he was hot. The short little article he did right here, he said, we have trouble in the classroom. He said, have you noticed what's going on? He said, we're putting lots of brand new textbooks in the classroom. He said, now, don't misunderstand me. He said, new textbooks is not the trouble. He says, the collective effect. He said, the more textbooks you put in the classroom, the more time you've got to spend on each textbook. He said, the more time you spend on each textbook, the less time you have available to spend on the Bible. He said, the Bible's starting to drift to the back of our classrooms, and this cannot be tolerated in American education. And so, having brought up the point, here's how he concludes this. I'll just read to you out of his article. He's concluding here. He said, why then, if these new books for children must be retained, as they will be, why should not the Bible regain the place it held as a schoolbook? Its morals are pure. Its examples are captivating and noble, and the reverence for the sacred book that is thus early impressed lasts long and probably, if not impressed in infancy, never takes firm hold of the mind. What does he know? He's just the author of the First Amendment. He's saying don't ever let the Bible get pushed to the back of the classroom, and today we can't even get it close to the classroom because the founding fathers wouldn't want that. You see, this is the irony, and the reason we have this little trouble that over the last three decades, we've been faithfully taught that those who founded this nation were, by and large, atheists and agnostics and deists. They weren't religious. Matter of fact, you may have seen this article. It ran in the local paper here recently. It's called "The Founding Fathers Were Not Christians," big emphasis on the word not. It's done by Stephen Morris, and his premise is very simple. It said, look, this is a secular nation. It's a secular government. It was founded by secular people. He said the guys who founded this were all atheists, agnostics, deists. They didn't want this religious stuff going on in public. Now, I find that at universities all over the nation now that students are not only taught that, but they're now tested that. The founding fathers, not any of them, believed in God. And of course, that affects public policy. I mean, when those kids become national leaders, if all these guys were atheists, agnostics, deists, it does make sense that they wouldn't want a cross in a cemetery. They wouldn't want a nativity scene. As a matter of fact, what are we doing with them? God, we trust on the money. They wouldn't want that. They were all atheists, agnostics, deists. And you see, that's how it affects public policy. So let's deal with that issue for just a moment. Now, what you have here on the screen in front of you, these are the 56 atheists that signed the Declaration of Independence. Now, well, that is the current portrayal. And I will quickly acknowledge that neither Jefferson or Franklin, neither one of these guys are Christians. Now, Jefferson will fight me. He specifically calls himself a Christian. In a letter to this man, Charles Thompson, in a letter to this man, Benjamin Rush, he calls himself a Christian, and he wonders why he's being criticized. His difficulty was he used a different definition than most. You see, he said that Jesus is a great prophet, but he wasn't divine. He wasn't the Son of God or the Savior of the world. So, despite the fact that Jefferson calls himself a Christian, I'm going to take exception and say, well, by an orthodox definition, any major Christian denomination, they're not going to buy that. So, aside from Jefferson and Franklin, you prove to me that anyone up on that screen is not a Christian, much less that he's an atheist or an agnostic or a deist. You got your work cut out for you. Let's start right here. You know who that is right there? That's the Reverend Dr. John Witherspoon. Reverend Dr. A minister in Congress? Oh, it's worse than that. He's a pastor and he's in Congress. And before you think that's strange, let me point out to you, of the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, 27 had seminary degrees. That's not bad for a bunch of atheists to have seminary degrees. In fact, fairly impressive. Now, John Witherspoon is responsible for two American translations of the Bible. This man, Charles Thompson, also responsible for an American translation of the Bible, Thompson's Bible. This man right here, Benjamin Rush, he founded America's very first Bible Society, the Philadelphia Bible Society. Within 8 years after he had done that, they thought it was such a wonderful idea, this group had started 121 Bible societies in America, which, again, is not bad for a bunch of atheists. And I can keep going by these guys. I can call them name after name. I can show you, for example, right here, Thomas McKean, what he did as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. Now, I've already said the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, whoa, you mentioned the Bible verse. Now we've got to overturn this. He had an altar call in his Supreme Court one day. And it's in the law library. It's a 1778 case called Respublica versus John Roberts. A guy had just been convicted and sentenced to death. He said, you're about to meet God and you're not ready to. You need to get ready to meet God. And so, I mean, tell me these guys. I guess that's not bad for an atheist to have an altar call in a courtroom. That's fairly impressive. We'd never try it today, but that's what these guys did. And how about the 55 atheists at the Constitutional Convention? Same fun. This guy right here, he's Abraham Baldwin. He's the founder of the University of Georgia, but he's America's youngest theologian. 7 years he was a chaplain in the American Revolution. At the age of 23, received a professorship of divinity at Yale University. This man right here is Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. This man right there is John Langdon. Those two men founded the American Bible Society. The same society that in the last 5 years has given out 10 million Bibles in Eastern Europe as the walls have come down. Started by those atheist founding fathers. Rufus King was also an original manager of the American Bible Society. This man, James McHenry. James McHenry is the founder of the Baltimore Bible Society. Only today it's called the Maryland Bible Society. We have here people like, there's Jacob Broom and there's John Dickinson. And over here you have Roger Sherman. I've already mentioned William Samuel Johnson. They were considered leading theologians of the day. They have large doctrinal treatises on the leading tenets of Christianity. I can keep going like this. As a matter of fact, if any of you go to Sunday school, thank these guys. 1791, they started the American Sunday School Union. You know who the first ever president of the American Sunday School Union was? Francis Scott Key, the man who authored the Star-Spangled Banner. For 52 consecutive years, he was president of that Sunday School Union. You know who were the officers? John Marshall, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, one of the officers in the Sunday School Union. Rod Washington, one of the justices of the Supreme Court. I mean, I keep going to the founders and show you what they started, what they did that we as Christians still enjoy today. Started by our atheist founding fathers. Well, I think one of the best depictions I've seen of the religious nature of the founding fathers was done in 1848. At that point in time, in 1848, a painting was commissioned to recapture and to portray what the founders said happened on September the 7th, 1774. Now, a lot of founders wrote about that. You'll find that in their writings, and I'll call some of them in a moment. But 1774, September the 7th, what happened then? If you go to any of the libraries, look at the records of Congress, you'll see that September the 7th, 1774, is the opening session of the U.S. Congress, first ever session. And you'll also see that those guys opened with prayer. And you'll also see that it wasn't a dinky little prayer. I mean, it wasn't like saying a blessing over your meal. It was serious stuff. And so many founders wrote about it. That's why the painting was done, because according to historical records, that opening prayer session in Congress lasted for 3 hours. Now, Matt pointed out that's not bad to get atheists to pray for 3 hours. I mean, we can't get religious people anywhere close to that, but our atheist founding fathers prayed for 3 hours. Now, you've got people here like Cushing and Ward, who wrote about what happened that morning. There's a great letter by Sam Adams talking about it, and John Adams. You ought to go to the library and get his letter on it, because he said not only did they pray that morning, he said they had a Bible study. He said, we studied Psalm 35 and Psalm 36 in Congress this morning. He said that God so spoke to them out of Psalm 35, so built their faith, that they finally believed for the first time that they could actually prevail over the British because of what they'd seen in Psalm 35. So in his letter, he begged us to please read Psalm 35 and please see what God had shown them in Congress that morning. Then you've got this man, Silas Dean, who went on to have a great career as an American diplomat. This is the way his letter went. He said, this was a prayer worth riding 100 miles to hear. He said, this is worth a week in the saddle to make this prayer gathering. And that's the same commitment as if we said, all right, pack up the car, the kids, let's drive 1,500 miles and see if we can make a good prayer meeting. A week in the car. He said, it's worth a week in the saddle to make this prayer gathering. He talked about how prayer started with Reverend Jacob Duchesne, but it didn't stop there. I mean, not only did they have prayer, they had Bible study. And one of the delegates said that during the entire time, that neither Patrick Henry nor George Washington came off their knees the entire time and knelt for the whole thing. Now, Silas Dean closed it this way. He said, after this time of prayer, he said, even the stern old Quakers had tears running down their cheeks. Quakers are least likely to cry. Even they were crying after that time of prayer in Congress. Atheists, agnostics, deists. Put it in perspective. 250 founding fathers, there are a dozen. They're definitely not Christians. Franklin and Jefferson and Joel Barlow, Thomas Paine, Henry Lee, Ethan Allen, Aaron Burr, Henry Dearborn. That's 5% of the founding fathers. They're not Christians. 5% not being Christians is a better ratio than what most churches have. And we're talking the Congress of the United States. Now, what happens in articles like this, Morris says, well, look at Thomas Paine and Jefferson and Franklin. He said, see, they weren't religious. He goes to the 5% and says this is what they were all like. Why not go through the 95% and say, you know, your average founding father started the American Bible Society, the American Tract Society, the American Sunday School Union, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, the American Constitutional Society, the Christian Constitutional Society. I just keep listing the organizations they started, many of which still exist today, started by these guys right there. But we don't hear about the 95%. We hear about the 5%, and that's supposed to change the tone. But you know what? Even if you didn't want to believe that the founding fathers, by and large, tend to be religious, you'd certainly have to talk about Ben Franklin. Everyone agrees he's one of the least religious of the founding fathers. Now, I don't dispute that. I mean, he absolutely is. Now, he is, by the way, a brilliant man. You see him right here. He's a very distinguished founding father. Only six founders signed both the Declaration and the Constitution. He's one of only six guys to sign both documents. You see, 1787 right here, he signs the Constitution. 11 years earlier, in this same room, he signed the Declaration on that table. Now, right here, Franklin, and you see him with his cane, by the way. A cane is not for show. Bless his heart, he needs that. He's 81 years old. He's America's oldest elder statesman, by far. Matter of fact, 81 doesn't sound very old today. Let me put it in perspective. You know what the average lifespan was in America at this point in time? Average lifespan was 35 years old. He's 81. Now, his body was falling apart, but his brain was still all together. If you ever go to Independence Hall in Philadelphia, you'll find the early form of a wheelchair that they used to get him on and off the floor of the convention. Two guys to get him on and out here. Go over to Franklin Court and you'll see that early wheelchair that they built for him. Franklin, in his latter years, as his body was falling apart, his mind was still there. I mean, he's a scientist. He's an inventor. By the way, do you know he's the guy who came up with daylight savings time? That's his invention. So Franklin, I mean, just a brilliant man, but he is one of the least religious founders. And so Thomas Paine, who is definitely one of the most anti-religious founders, Thomas Paine thought that Franklin would be real friendly to this book that he was working on, which is The Age of Reason. Now, The Age of Reason was a specific attack on religion, a specific attack on Christianity and a general attack on religion. And in it, he said, you know, religion's really bad for a country. He said, you need to get rid of it. Christianity just is terrible for a nation. And Paine went through that. But before he published it, he took a handwritten copy of his manuscript and sent it to his old friend Ben Franklin. Franklin's the guy who brought Thomas Paine to America. Paine was an Englishman. 1772, Franklin brought him over here as a printer, and they developed a friendship that lasted for a couple decades there. So he sends it to Franklin. Franklin reviews this. Now, you want to read a fun letter, you go to the library and get Franklin's letter back to Thomas Paine, 1790. Now, Franklin's known for his pithy statements, his little proverbs, Poor Richard's Almanac. You'll see several of them in this letter. Now, remember, here he is, one of the least religious founding fathers. He has in his hands a manuscript attacking religion. Look what he tells Thomas. He said, Thomas, you wanted my opinion on this. He said, at present, I shall only give you my opinion that the consequence of printing this piece will be a great deal of odium drawn upon yourself, mischief to you, and no benefit to others. He said, he that spits in the wind spits in his own face. Now, Franklin jumping all over a guy for attacking religion. And Franklin continues. He said, but were you to succeed, he said, do you imagine any good would be done by it? He said, think how great a portion of mankind have need of the motives of religion to restrain them from vice, to support their virtue. He said, I would advise you, therefore, not to attempt unchaining the tiger, but to burn this piece before it's seen by any other. He said, if men are so wicked with religion, what would they be if without it? He said, I intend this letter as a proof of my friendship. And there is one other thing that is really striking here. One of the points that Paine had made was, he said, look at me. He said, I am not religious, and I have morality, I have integrity, I have honesty, I have all these characteristics that you say go with religious people, and I'm not religious, and I have it. Franklin addressed that specifically. He said, you know, Thomas, I've known you a long time. You do have honesty, integrity, and morality, but I got to point out something to you. He said, you're indebted to her originally, that is, to your religious education, for the habits of virtue which you now justly value upon yourself. He said, let's not forget that you went to a religious school, and that's where you learned the difference between right and wrong and all these things you now think are so great. You see, I don't care if my neighbor is an atheist, but I sure will appreciate it if he'll live by the Ten Commandments, not kill and steal and whatever. You don't have to be religious to live by those principles, and that's what Franklin pointed out to Paine. He said, these are great principles to live by. Now, you don't have to believe in them doctrinally, but if you're just adhere to them in society, it makes a great society. So, I mean, I can keep, how many more founding fathers you want? I mean, we can go like this for a long time. You see, there's enough there to at least raise some questions, but we're obviously not where we used to be, clearly. And I do find it striking, however, that we had a very consistent view of the First Amendment for about a century and a half. As a matter of fact, if you look at court records from 1789 all the way through 1789 through 1952, you'll find that it was an unalterable policy in Supreme Court decisions that we never separated religious expression, religious practices, religious texts from any aspect of public life. We just didn't do it. Matter of fact, the case that came to the court in 1952 was called Zurich versus Clausen. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, time out, wait a minute. They said, are you suggesting that we should separate religious instruction from public education? They said, is that what you're suggesting? Is that your intimation? They said, we can't do that. That's inconceivable. They said, that'd violate our history, our tradition, our case law, our precedent. There's no way we're going to do that. 1952, the Supreme Court still thought it was utterly inconceivable to separate those two realms. Now, look how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. The real turn, as far as case law goes, happened in 1962, in this case, Engle versus Vitale. We had a new court, the Earl Warren Court. This court is considered to be the most judicially active court we've ever had in America's history. And this particular court said, you know, this thing about having prayer in schools, now, this has got to come to a grinding halt. And so for three decades now, Americans have been taught that school prayer is one of the chief reasons the Founding Fathers gave us the First Amendment. You see, they found school prayer reprehensible. It was repugnant to them. They didn't want it. That's why they gave us the First Amendment. Real simple question. If the founders didn't want prayer in schools, why in the world didn't they take it out? Why was it constitutional for 170 consecutive years until the Warren Court discovered that we weren't supposed to have it? Now, the next year, in these two cases, Abney and Shemp and Mary Colette, the court also said, now, this thing about using the Bible, we can't have you do that in schools anymore either. Now, I brought a very specific book here. This is one of the rarest books in America. This little book right here, and that's the cover page of it right there. I took a picture of the cover page. This book is the first ever Bible printed in the English language in America. This is America. There were 20,000 copies originally done. There's only 52 that are still known to exist. One of the rarest books in America right here. Now, this little book, first Bible printed in the English language in America, you know when it was printed? 1782. You know who printed it? The Congress of the United States. Congress did? Who's in Congress then? All the founding fathers. What'd they print a Bible for? Well, you turn right over to the intro here. See, here's that cover page that I have up on the screen. Turn right there. This is a Bible, quote, for the use of schools. Founding fathers printed a Bible for schools? It's a piece of cake to show the founding fathers wanted the Bible in schools, because there it is, right there, printed by Congress for the use of our schools. You see, we've obviously reached the point of absurdity if you're going to use historical intent. If the court's going to say purpose and mandate and the intent of the First Amendment, boy, they're not anywhere close to it. You see, this is we've even reached the point where we had in case Stone v. Graham, one of three cases that came to the court. The court said, you know, we know that the Ten Commandments have some religious stuff in them, and we just, because of that, we can't let kids see the Ten Commandments at all. Now, the thing I find striking about this is that if you look for copies of the Ten Commandments, you're not about to find them in churches. Very few churches I know of have ever had a copy of the Ten Commandments hanging. But if you dead fire sure want to find yourself a copy of the Ten Commandments, you need to go to a government building somewhere. You need to go to the courthouse. You need to go to the legislature. Just hop a plane to Washington, D.C., walk in the U.S. Supreme Court, because engraved in two locations, there hang the Ten Commandments. Why? Because from a purely secular point of view, no religion involved, a secular historian will acknowledge the Ten Commandments have been the basis of civil law in the Western world for 2,000 years. That's where we learned the prohibitions on murder and theft and perjury. And so we thought, now surely you're not going to tell us that kids can't see what's hanging inside the U.S. Supreme Court? I mean, you won't do that, will you? And the court said, yeah, actually we will. They said, you know, in Stone v. Graham, they said if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments were to have any effect at all, it would be to induce the school children to read them. And of course, if they were to read the Ten Commandments, they would meditate on them, certainly. And if they would meditate on them, they might respect and obey them. And that's just unconstitutional. We can't have kids obeying religious teachings at school. Now, there was a case 2 years ago, State of Florida versus George T. Broxson. George Broxson was on trial for his life, accused of the brutal murder of his 4-year-old stepdaughter. In that particular case, tried in that court, that court, like most others, had a copy of the Ten Commandments hanging there. You know what? The judge ordered the copy of the Ten Commandments to be covered because the judge said, if jurors were to see that one that says, don't kill, they'd be biased against this guy, and he wouldn't get a fair trial if they saw the one that said, don't kill. Time out. What's the guy on trial for if it's not for that? Yeah, but that's religion. You can't have religion influence in society. Now, what do you think happens when you have a national policy that tells 56 million young people, we're not about to let you see the Ten Commandments. You might obey them. We can't have that going on. The Department of Justice reports that since that point in time, violent crime has increased 694%. Maybe that's coincidence. It's an interesting correlation nonetheless. I mean, it seems to make a little bit of logical sense. See, the difficulty we have is America is a self-governing nation. What is the key to a self-governing nation? Self-governing people. People can't keep themselves under control. Their government can't. You know what? If you can't obey something as simple as the Ten Commandments, if you can't obey the one that says, do not kill, our Constitution doesn't stand a chance with you. It's got no way to keep you under control if you can't control yourself by those very principles. And that's why John Adams, in the speeches he gave October the 13th, 1798, John Adams said, we have no government armed with power which is capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. He said, there's no government that has enough force to make people do what's right if they can't control themselves. He continued, look at his statement. He said, our Constitution is made only for a moral and a religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Now, is John Adams a significant voice? I would say so. There's only two folks that signed the First Amendment. He's one of the two folks that signed the First Amendment. I mean, that kind of makes him a little bit of an expert to speak on the thing. He said, our Constitution only works for moral and religious people. And we understood that for generations. That's why when Daniel Webster gave the speech laying the cornerstone at the addition of the U.S. Capitol, he pointed out, he said, you know, we're laying the cornerstone here, but he said, that rock is not the cornerstone of civil government. He said, it is religious principles. And this is a speech that he gave, part of it. He said, the cultivation of the religious sentiment represses licentiousness. It inspires respect for law and order, and it gives strength to the whole social fabric. See, that was the understanding we had for all those years. Best friends civil government have is religious principles, because they taught you to control yourself. And if you can't control yourself, nobody else can. I mean, not even a baseball bat. We don't have enough jails in America to control people who don't want to control themselves. It has to be done from the inside. That's what we always understood. But now, oh no, our founders wouldn't want that. Well, obviously we've come a long way with this, and this leads to the question. Now, this is all original intent. This is the way it was set up to be. Do we want it that way today? Well, the argument is no. We shouldn't be stuck with values that are 200 years old. We ought to be able to evolve this thing, move along. So the court has done that. In 1789, the first test on the First Amendment was what is a real establishment test. Federal government can't set up a single denomination. We used that all the way till 1947. In the case Everson versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court said, you know, we know this was just designed for the federal government, but we think it ought to apply to the states as well. So we're also going to say that the state can't have religious activities going on. And then in 1962, the court redefined the word in establishment in the case Engle-Vitale. They said, you know, establishment used to mean setting up a national denomination or a state denomination, but now establishment means allowing a religious activity. And we can't have that going on. We can't have a government entity allowing a religious activity. Then we got to 1971 in the Lemon Test. Lemon Test said, well, the only way that a religious activity in public can be constitutional is if it's secular. Explain that one to me. How can a religious activity be secular? But that's what the court said. Any religious activity that's not secular is not going to be constitutional. Then we get to 1984, and the court comes up with a new one. It says, you know, we need an endorsement test. If there's anything that makes it look like the government is favorable to religion or even promoting religious or allowing religious principles to be promoted, that's unconstitutional. So we now have the endorsement test. Then in 1992, the court in Lee versus Wiseman came up with a psychological coercion test. It said, you know, if there is a single person out there who is offended by a religious activity in their presence, that activity is unconstitutional. You got to protect a single person from being offended by anything that goes on around them. So the psychological court, and see, that's what happened in that invocation case, because there was one man there who was offended that the word God was used. And the court said, we know millions want the word God used, but we can't have this guy offended. So the psychological coercion test says, if you don't like the way it's going on, you can stop any religious activity around you. Now, that is an evolution of the Constitution. It's a living, organic document. The only difficulty is we didn't have anything to do with that. Nine unelected judges told us what our values should be in all these arenas. Now, I argue all day long for an evolving, changing Constitution. You know why? Because that was original intent. The Constitution, Article 5, says, if you don't like the way it's going, amend the Constitution. That's how we evolve the Constitution. If we don't, and that's why we came out with the 13th Amendment. We said, you know, we don't like the fact, we people don't like the fact that the Constitution didn't abolish slavery, so we're going to do it, 13th Amendment. Then we come up with the 16th Amendment. We say, you know, we don't like the fact that we can't have direct taxes on our income, which is prohibited by the Constitution. So we amended it to say, now we can directly tax ourselves, income tax. Then we came along the 17th Amendment and said, you know, we the people, we really don't like states appointing senators. We want to elect senators. So we went to direct election of senators, which was not the way the Constitution was designed. Then we got to the 19th Amendment. We said, you know, we really don't think it's right that only men vote. Women need to vote, too. So we modified the Constitution. Then we got to the 22nd Amendment. We said, you know, we don't want our presidents holding more than two terms. So we limited it to two terms. Then we got the 26th Amendment. We said, you know, kids 18 years old ought to be able to vote. We have amended the Constitution all over the place. We have evolved it to meet our values. The difficulty we have right now is the constitutional amendments that are currently before Congress are not to amend the Constitution. They're to amend the court's opinions of the Constitution. It's out of the hands of the people. The Founding Fathers said, if you want it to change, fine, let it change, but just let it be the will of the people. That's why people like Sam Adams, one of the anti-federalists I told you about, look what he said. He said, the people alone have the incontestable, unalienable, and indefeasible right to initiate, to institute government, and to reform, alter, or totally change the same when their protection or safety or prosperity or happiness. Only the people can change the Constitution. He said, and the federal Constitution, according to the mode prescribed therein, he said, has already undergone such amendments in several parts of it as from experience the people judge necessary. We've already amended it, even back then, because we wanted to change. Washington in his farewell address, he said the same thing. He said, now, if in the opinion of the people, the distribution of the modification of the constitutional powers in any way, any particular, be wrong, he said, let it be corrected by an amendment, and the way which the Constitution designates. He said, but let there be no change by usurpation. Don't let somebody come through and say, well, let's have something new. He says, for though this, in one instance, may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. See, that's the difficulty we have. We now got nine guys telling us what we can do and when we can do it and where we can do it. And that's not our will. That hasn't been our will. If we were up to the will of the people, we'd still have a lot of things the way we had them. Not everything. People don't want everything the way it was. But we know best what we want. We don't need people telling us what we need. We know best. And that's why the founders said, hey, we've built evolution right in the Constitution. You don't like it? You change it. Now,
We've obviously moved away from that, and so I would contend that that's been a real problem. So I want to close with a couple of statements from founding fathers, kind of put this in perspective. This man is William Patterson. As I mentioned, he's one of the signers of the Constitution. You see a signature there from New Jersey. It's that signature across the bottom here on the slide. William Patterson was put on the Supreme Court by George Washington. Now, he had the distinction of being on the court for 2 decades after the Constitution was in place. 1806, 1807, 1808, etc. He was still in the court. And as a distinguished jurist, as a signer of the Constitution, he frequently addressed legal groups, addressed judicial groups, addressed grand juries, etc. And in so doing, he would talk about the elevated position that America had received in only 2 decades, that we'd already become one of the top nations in the world, much of it due to that Constitution right there. He said, but I'll tell you, and he talked about the part he played in that, and he was humbled and gratified by having done that, helped create the document that brought us there. He said, but, he said, that Constitution does not guarantee that we will stay a great nation. He said, if that Constitution ever becomes coupled with bad leaders, he said, that Constitution becomes worthless. Now, the point I want to make is going back to that 1992 case, Lee Wiseman, Invocations Benediction, Supreme Court case. Our argument to the court was very simple. We said, look, guys, here are the signers of the Constitution that prayed graduation prayers, and here's the prayers they prayed. And they didn't just pray graduation prayers. Here's some of the Bible verses they used. And it wasn't that they had anything against religion schools anyway, because here's the Bible that they did for these, and we just went through the history. We just went through the stuff. But we still lost the case 5-4. Justice Souter, in his concurring opinion, acknowledged the arguments. He said, you know, we've seen here the Founding Fathers condoned school prayer. We've seen that the Founders actually participated in graduation prayers and actually encouraged graduation prayers. He said, that just goes to prove the Founding Fathers didn't understand the Constitution. Thank you very much, David Souter. How much of the original constitutional protection for freedom of religion do we still have today? We've coupled it with leaders who want to read it their way instead of the way the people want it read, instead of the way it had been for so long. You see, that's the difficulty, and that was Patterson's point. And that's why Jefferson said, if we ever get to this point, great letter. He actually, in 1804 and 1805, he has a lot of long letters on the judiciary, but this is one of them. He said, if we ever accept the hypothesis that the Supreme Court is capable of changing the Constitution, if we ever reach that, he said, the Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. He said, if we ever arrive at the point where we say the Constitution is to be interpreted by the courts, he said, it just becomes a thing of wax. They'll twist it in whatever they want to. They'll find anything new they want. He said, it should be remembered as an axiom of eternal truth in politics that whatever power in any government is independent is absolute also. He said, if you stick the court over there and say that we, the people, have no control over that, he said, they're the absolute power of the nation. He actually called them an oligarchy in a different letter. And that's where we've been. You see, according to the Supreme Court's own description, in the McCollum case, the Supreme Court announced that it had become a, quote, super board of education for every school district in the nation. Just what we need, a federal board of education with 9 unelected board members on it. You see, they're telling us what we can and can't do in our schools. And then the court went on to say, in the Allegheny ACLU case, there was assuming the role of a, quote, National Board of Theology. Which we really need that, a National Board of Theology. That's what the court has become. It tells us what religious practice we can do, when, where, and how. And then in the 1992 case, the court described itself as amateur psychologist on a psycho journey. That really puts a lot of confidence in you, doesn't it? See, that's the kind of stuff that runs the nation. And that's never original intent. That's not even the changing, evolving intent. That mechanism to evolve is there. It's the people. It's in our hands, and that's where it's supposed to stay. So it gives you a little idea of the change of the First Amendment, what's happened, where it used to be, and where we are. I guess I'll close with a piece of good news. This past Wednesday in Dick Armey's office, we finalized the wording for a constitutional amendment that will roll back the last 40 years of federal court decisions on religion, put the whole issue back in the hands of the people, take it completely out of the realm of the Supreme Court. Says, look, people in their communities know what they do and they don't want. It ought to be up to them, not to a bunch of unelected judges, to tell us what our religious practices are going to be. So that is now on the way through. You'll hear about it in the next couple of weeks. Whether we can or can't get it through, who knows. But we're at least moving in the right direction for the first time in a long while to put this back in the hands of the people. I know it's been long tonight, guys. Thank you. God bless.
The following tape was recorded by David Barton. His ministry's name is Wall Builders, Incorporated, P.O. Box 397, Aledo, Texas, A-L-E-D-O, Texas, 76008. The telephone number is area code 817-441-6044. God bless you now. Bye.